Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm trying to decide whether to talk about what day it is today or not. I'm not quite sure how many of you would fit under this category. But it is Multiple Personalities Day. So I'll just leave it at that, kind of wondering which personalities you've brought with you today. And hopefully they're the good ones. So lots of things happening. Don't forget there's one more class assignment that's going to be due Friday, and that's going to be the end of those. So make sure that you get that in. I've graded the assignment that was due last Friday and turned it back, and I want to talk about that in just a minute. We've got a couple other things that I want to talk about first. So the creative projects. Boy, did I get a batch of interesting creative projects. Some of you are so incredibly creative. I got things all the way from like a computer game that a person developed to storybooks to different kinds of models to, gosh, just all kinds of fun things. And those have all been, I've gone through them all and graded them, and those of you that turned them in, I emailed you a brief description of the grade that you got on that project. I've still got all of them spread out in the lab room. Now, I'm going to be teaching lab in that room this afternoon, so they're going to all get put away. But for the say until maybe 1 o'clock, if any of you have a little time and you'd like to walk through and see some of the things that people did, you're more than welcome to do that. So I've got them all spread out in the lab room if you want to take a peek at them. And as I said, then they're going to get put together and disappeared. Now I do have one creative project that is an incredible mystery to me. It was turned in on a flash drive. There's no name, and it's not a finished product that I can view. So, if any of you recognize this rather nice little flash drive, you know you turned the project in on that, please see me, because we need to talk about this project, because it's right now it's hidden away inside this little flash drive, and it's not in a form that people without the program that made it can access it. So keep that in mind. Okay, so that's the creative projects, really cool things by and large. Okay, let's go back to the assignment that you did for this week. I wanted to talk about it just a little bit, because this idea of a bird flu really scared the medical community, because flus, although we know, we feel that all of the different flus that we suffer from probably originated in birds, and the birds continue to harbor different kinds of varieties of flus and so forth, many of which we've never seen in the human population. The thought of a flu jumping directly from a bird to a human, which doesn't normally happen, was just a scary thing. And especially if that flu then be mutated to the point where it could jump from person to person. That's what the people were really, really concerned about trying to figure out what was going on there. Normally, as you read about, there's an intermediate host, like a pig or something, that where the bird flus can replicate and reproduce in a pig, and then they'll mutate within the pig, and then they'll jump from the pig to the human that way. That's the more normal route. But the idea, because bird flus just aren't designed to survive in humans. They need to undergo some changes. So that's what that was all about. And this idea of a pandemic, you know, a widespread illness covering a large portion of a country or maybe a large portion of the world, that's what they were really concerned about, especially with the experience that we've had with pandemics in the past. You know, the Spanish flu in 1918 was terrible. It killed millions of people. And in a second, I'm going to show you a little video about how it spread across the United States, how rapidly that can spread once it gets going. So people were really concerned about that. You saw that there are two proteins in particular that seem to be really important in helping the influenza type A. Now, there are different kinds of influenza. There's a type B also, which is not as a serious a disease as influenza type A. But there are two proteins in particular with the influenza type A that are involved in not only helping that flu virus to get inside the cell. So for a virus to get into a cell, it has to be able to come in contact with the cell, first of all. Viruses don't move on their own. They're not living particles. They're just kind of knocked around by the world around them. But they first got to come in contact with a suitable host cell. And second, they've got to stick to that cell. So there are proteins on the outside of the cell that the proteins on the virus are going to bind to, and that's what's going to provide them with that entryway. And so the two proteins, the one hemagglutinin is a protein that seems to be involved in helping the virus to get into the cell and to stick to the cell. Red blood cells in particular, but other kinds of cells also have the appropriate kind of protein on the outside of the cell that allows that virus to stick to it. And the hemagglutinin is interesting in other aspects too, because not only does it help them to get into the cell, but along with the neuraminidase, the hemagglutinin helps the neuraminidase to bind to receptors on proteins in mucus. Now, you know, we tend not to like to talk about mucus and so forth. It's one of those things, snotty noses and things. But there are proteins in there that these things will bind to. And when the neuraminidase binds to these proteins, then it stimulates more mucus production. So you start to hear the symptoms of the flu now, you know, the kinds of things. Mucus also is kind of what you might call the home of choice for the influenza type A virus. So it will persist in mucus over a long period of time. So binding these proteins results in congestion and upper respiratory tract symptoms of the flu, and it also helps in the dispersal of the viral particles, because, you know, either contact, little kids with their runny noses and wiping them and touching things, you know, that's why you're warned, you know, keep cleaning your hands when there's a flu virus epidemic going on in the area. Because the contact is one way, and then sneezing and coughing, because when you sneeze or cough, the mucus gets aerosolized. I'm not sure if that's a word or not, but you know, all these little particles, liquid particles, go out, and the flu virus is in those particles. So that's another way that it gets out there. So important proteins. The neuraminidase also helps in the release of the virus from the cell that it's in, and so a cell that gets infected over a period of time will start producing more and more of these things, and eventually that infection is going to kill that cell. But the neuraminidase is involved in doing that. So one way of kind of helping to combat some of these infections is by using neuraminidase inhibitors, ASE ending, right? Neuraminidase, it's an enzyme that cleaves a particular type of thing from a molecule, and that's how it helps the viral particle to get out of the cell. So by inhibiting that neuraminidase, that helps to perhaps limit the severity of the infection. So anyway, that's what you were reading about there. Let me just shut this off. I got a little quick PowerPoint to show you. Oh, okay, so that's what the influenza type A virus looks like. It's an RNA virus, so there's RNA on the inside. There's a protein coat. There's a membrane that came from the host cell. So the human viruses are always like that. They're always taking membrane from the cell that they've infected, and that's the outermost layer, and then that's how they're going to get into the next host cell, is by that membrane binding with the host cell membrane and then allowing that viral particle in. These little spiky things, those are proteins that have been inserted in that membrane, and those are the neuraminidase and hemagglutinin proteins, as well as other proteins that are on the outside there. So that's what it looks like. Here's another picture. Electron micrographs are never in color, right? So somebody's colorized this. But again, you can see there's the outer membrane. And these are the proteins themselves, okay? The neuraminidase and the hemagglutinin proteins. If you purify them, that's kind of what they're going to look like. And that's an artist's rendition of what's going on, where the hemagglutinin is are kind of those green inverted spikes. They're proteins sticking out like that. And the neuraminidase are these other, almost look like large thumbtacks or something out there that are sticking out from that cell membrane. And we know, as an RNA virus, kind of the pathway of what goes on, the virus is going to get into the cell, the contents of that virus, the RNA is going to get released, the host cell is going to produce new viral particles, and they're going to blub them off the outside and infect. But as an RNA virus, we know even more specifically, this is a slide of HIV infection, not influenza infection, but it goes through the stages that we've talked about. So getting into the cell, there's that membrane, gets it into the cell, the RNA is released, it converts it to DNA, the DNA goes into the nucleus and inserts itself into the host cell nucleus, your own DNA in there, and then that starts directing the formation of those specialized proteins that get put into that cell membrane and the more RNA and so forth, and eventually we get more viral particles being shed from the cell. All right, so that's influenza virus works that way too. You may have felt like that at times. Okay, watch this real closely. This is a time lapse. It lasts about, 4 weeks or so? And it's the spread. This is the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic in the United States. And you can see how quickly on this computer it's not going to work. Okay, be that way, Mr. PC. I understand you. Watch how quickly it spreads. It's starting in certain areas and then spreading across the entire United States within about a 4 week period of time. That was in 1918. You know, think about how transportation has changed in the last 100 years. It wasn't easy to get from the East Coast to the West Coast in 1918 by any means. And yet that influenza spread that quickly at that point in time. So that's why the people were so worried about the bird flu. If that really got established in the population, how quickly could that spread completely around the world? It would be a new and novel flu that the human population had never seen before, and it would wreak havoc with people. They were concerned about millions of lives being lost. So that's the influenza and stuff. Our bodies will adapt to that, right? Our immune systems will identify it and eliminate it. But remember, it takes for that primary response 10 days at least to really generate that primary response. So if you survive the first 10 days of a novel influenza infection, you might come out on the other end okay, and certainly you'd have immunity at that point. Interesting thing about the swine flu that people were so worried about just a few years ago. It turned out to be the same, the H1N1, as the Spanish flu. And people discovered that in the older populations, like the population of people 65 and older, they had come into contact with that sometime previously, because that was the population that was fairly immune to that swine flu when it was circulating around at that point in time. That was a real surprise to the epidemiologists and people, because you think, okay, that was way back in 1918 or something. And but that was they had come into contact with it somewhere along the way, later than that swine flu or the Spanish flu epidemic. So we come into contact with these things as we're going along. We may not know what we're coming into contact with, but hopefully they'll prepare us for future contact. Yeah.
So are you saying that the Spanish influenza and the swine flu are actually the same?
They were both H1N1s. Mm-hmm. That's right. But they were slightly different variations. But currently, not enough of a variation that this older population that had come into contact with that at some other time didn't have some immunity to it. So, yeah. So the flu shots. You know, what do they do with the flu shots? They're constantly monitoring what flus are breaking out, and they're looking at the Far East, and because it takes a while for something to break out there and move over here. So they're looking Right now, they're looking to see, okay, what are the flu variants that are going on in the Far East right now? And let's model our next year's flu shot based on those variants, because that's the presumably the most likely flu to hit the United States 6 months or a year from now. But the flu shots are really a gamble, because it takes quite a while just to ramp up your production to make the, and it's always a different mix, right? So it takes a while to ramp up your production. And so you're guessing. The people that are making them are guessing what are going to be the prevalent flus that year. Sometimes they hit on pretty well. Sometimes they don't hit on worth a darn. And there's a whole controversy that is starting to brew now about the efficacy of the flu shots anyway. Do they really do what people think that they do when you're being told, I got to get your flu shot, got to get your flu shot, because the flu's coming, does it really protect you like people think they do? So that's a good thing to kind of keep an eye on over the next few years as people are trying to figure that out and decide whether flu shots are helpful or harmful or neutral, you know, what's going on with those. So, anyway, flu, good old flu, love the flu, no, hate the flu, something like that with the flu. Okay, so let's see. Now there's probably nothing else to look at there. I've lost my control. This is my control. I don't want you to think I went out of control. Okay, I just lost my control. Okay. Whew. So, moving on. We've been looking at the nervous system, right? And we looked a little more closely at the action potential, that being the nervous impulse. We looked more closely at that last time. We had seen how it's generated. Anything that's got those voltage-gated sodium and potassium proteins in their membrane will most likely be an electrically excitable cell. That's what sets those things apart from other cells. Our skin cells don't have those. Our nerve cells do, our muscle cells do, and so forth. And that's what allows for a nervous impulse to go down the link. So we've been talking about that now, and I talked last time about four things to remember, right? And these were really important things. The idea that we don't get an action potential until we hit the critical level of depolarization. So if we've got an event going on that starts to depolarize a cell membrane, unless it depolarizes it enough, we're not going to get an action potential. But once it reaches that critical level, which is about minus 50 millivolts, so going from about minus 70 to about minus 50, once we reach that, then we get that action potential, and unless something's really wrong with that nerve cell or that muscle cell or something, that action potential is then going to run the length of the nerve cell, or it's going to spread out from the location in the muscle cell where it was generated and run the length of the muscle cell also. So once we hit the critical level, we saw that it's an all or none phenomenon, right? That we either get a full action potential or no action potential, no half action potentials, no three-quarter action potentials. We're either going to get it or not. We saw that it traveled the length without decrement, so it was as strong at the end as it was at the beginning, and also the refractory period, which was really important for keeping that action potential from moving backwards, keeping it moving forwards all the time, because that refractory period was that very, very brief amount of time once an action potential has passed an area during which the sodium gates will not open again. And so that protects us from that activity moving in all directions all the time, so that when you first stimulate a nerve, it will never stop. I mean, if we didn't have the refractory period, that's what would happen. You stimulate a nerve, it would never stop with messages going back and forth, probably until it ran out of energy. It would take so much energy to keep the ion balance correct that was what would stop it. We talked about the transmission of that to the next cell, and that was very general in the synapse. And an action potential gets to the end plate. It causes little vesicles filled with neurotransmitter to move to and bind with the membrane in the end plate. We release that neurotransmitter into the fluid in the synapse, and that neurotransmitter then diffuses across, binds with a binding protein in the postsynaptic cell, and then either does or does not depolarize that next cell. So if we get enough neurotransmitter moving over, and if it's bound enough to its receptor, then it will probably depolarize that next cell to the critical level, and it'll send off an action potential on the next cell. It's interesting, you think back to the heart. We're going to look at the heart again in just a second, but you think back to the heart. Remember that there were two neurotransmitters that we talked about with the heart. There was acetylcholine, whose effect was to actually slow down the rate of heartbeat, and there was norepinephrine, whose effect was to speed up the rate of heartbeat. And remember I told you that the nerves were all coming into the same area. They're all coming into the SA node. So based on what you know about synapses now and so forth, you know that those postsynaptic cells in the SA node have to have receptors for both acetylcholine and norepinephrine in them. And depending on which one binds, that's going to determine whether that heart rate is going to speed up or slow down. Okay, so your neurotransmitter always has to have a specialized receptor protein. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And we talked about things like myasthenia gravis, which is an autoimmune disease which wipes out the acetylcholine receptor proteins, right? So if you lose your population of receptor proteins, then you're going to have trouble getting that signal across that gap, getting the signal across the synapse. The same is true with hormone action. When we talked about regulating blood sugar level and so forth. Type 2 diabetes, one thing that can cause type 2 diabetes is if the insulin receptors on the cells that insulin is targeting, if those cells either don't produce enough of the insulin receptors or something covers the insulin receptors and so forth, you can have plenty of insulin, but if you don't have enough receptors, you're not going to get the response. So that's kind of a common theme. Whenever you've got some sort of a chemical messenger that's targeting a cell, there are going to need to be receptors in that cell membrane that it's targeting that's going to bind with, and then it's going to cause some sort of an effect to occur. So we see that here too. We talked about how we remove that acetylcholine from the synapse. We break it down. There's that enzyme in the membrane that breaks it down. So two proteins in the membrane for acetylcholine. One, if it binds to that, it's going to allow sodium to leak in. The other, if it binds to it, it's going to break it apart. So it's kind of random. You know, there's the acetylcholine is going to bind with one or the other. And remember that binding with the receptor protein is an on and off kind of thing. It's not irreversible. It's very reversible. So the acetylcholine will bind, come off, and then move over a little bit, bind, hit the esterase, and boom, it's broken down. It's no longer active. And again, with neurotransmitters, there's always got to be some mechanism for getting that neurotransmitter out of the synapse. You know, whether it's breaking it down, whether it's reabsorbing it quickly back into the end plate or something like that, there's got to be a mechanism for clearing the synapse. Otherwise, you're going to be continually stimulating the postsynaptic cell. And that doesn't work real well, generally, with the nervous system. Talked about muscle contraction again, so a little review of that. I think I've told you about that at least three times now this term. Keep coming back to that. Problems at the neuromuscular junction, potential problems, different toxins, autoimmune diseases, military nerve gases, fun things. And then we talked about inhibitory neurons also last time and how their effect is hyperpolarize the cell that they synapse with. And by hyperpolarizing, it makes it that much harder for that cell to depolarize, to reach the critical level of depolarization. And that's how we regulate a lot of activities in the nervous system and so forth. Okay, so lots going on with nerves. Any questions about this stuff before I tell you a few more things about this? Okay. So, in your lecture notes then, on page 65, there's a little table that just shows you a few neurotransmitters. There's a bunch of neurotransmitters. It seems like we find more all the time, especially deep in the brain, the neurotransmitters that are doing specialized things. But these are some of the more common ones, and just give you an idea in the brain and spinal cord what effects these things have when they're present. So norepinephrine, there again, norepinephrine obviously gets used for a lot of different things because not only is it the neurotransmitter speed up the heart, but it's a neurotransmitter in the brain to affect mood and pleasure, reward, and so forth. It's also a hormone that gets circulated around, a very useful hormone. Dopamine, involved in controlling movement. People who have problems with movement and so forth are often treated with dopamine of one type or another to try to increase those levels. The endorphins and enkephalins are great because they inhibit pain conduction. So when you're out there on the 49th mile of your 50-mile run, I don't know why anybody would run 50 miles, to tell you the truth. But a couple of years ago, we had an assistant teaching in the class who is a long-distance runner and would run 100 miles. And it's like, what's chasing him? I don't know. Anyway, it inhibits pain conduction. You get out there and you know, the runner's high that they talk about and so forth would be caused by these things. Gamma-aminobutyric acid and glycine, inhibitory pathways, they're involved in those and so forth. So just a few different neurotransmitters to give you a feel for the different kinds of things that they might do. Now, I wanted to go back and take a look real quick at the heart again, because you probably remember when I was talking about the heart, I had to skim over a few things because I said, it's not going to make sense now because we haven't talked about the nerves. Well, now we've talked about the nerves, so I just want to revisit the heart and explain a couple of things, especially about how norepinephrine and acetylcholine actually regulate the rate of heartbeat, and why is it that we can actually see an electrocardiogram, because we all measured them in lab. Why can we actually see all of those components? What's different about what's going on in the heart? So if we were to take and do an intracellular recording of cells at the SA node. Now remember, the SA node is where the heartbeat's being generated from, right? So every time that depolarizes and fires, it's going to send out an electrical signal. It's going to send out action potentials that are going to be picked up by the heart muscle fibers. That's going to be the trigger for contraction. All right, so every time that depolarizes and fires, we're going to get a contraction. If we were to do an intracellular recording there, so we're going to identify some of those cells. We'll have one probe on the inside, one probe on the outside. We'd see something that looks like this. So there's our zero, our plus, and our minus, and this is in millivolts, and this is going to be time down here. So I suppose I need to put some numbers in here. We would see some activity like this. So let's start recording after a heartbeat, so we're kind of in that in-between time. So we'd see the residual from that previous action potential coming in, so we'd kind of overshoot, and then we'd see it go back up. Now, what we would normally expect with the nerve and muscle that we've talked about is that, okay, let's say that this is the resting potential, right? So we would normally expect that to kind of flatten out there until the next signal came along, right? Well, that's not what happens in the heart. So the heart is a little bit different. Now, remember what causes this resting potential. Remember, it was the leakage of potassium out of the cell. So once we pumped all that potassium in and the sodium out, some of that potassium leaks back out. And that's why we have it more negative on the inside of the cell than the positive. There are proteins that do that. It's not just accidental. There are actually proteins in the membrane that allow that potassium at a slow rate to leak out to give us that minus 70 millivolts. In the heart muscle, that protein's a little bit different. And as time goes on, that protein channel starts to shut down. So in everything else, that protein channel is going to stay open. You're going to get this slow leakage. But in the heart muscle, that protein channel starts to shut down. And as that channel starts to shut down, that means that there's going to be less and less potassium leaking out. Right? If there's less potassium leaking out, that means we're going to depolarize the cell, because it was the leakage of potassium out that caused the polarity in the first place. So what we see in the hard muscle is that it doesn't stop. There's not a resting potential per se at the SA node. It actually continues to go up, depolarizing, and then of course we're going to hit that critical level. So let's say that this is our critical level. So that's our critical level of depolarization. Eventually that'll shut down enough so that we're depolarized enough, we hit the critical level, and of course that's going to stimulate an action potential. So all of a sudden we're going to get an action potential coming out of here and coming down, and then we're going to see the same thing repeat itself again. So a little overshoot and so forth. We don't stop at a resting potential. We're going to keep going until we hit that critical level again, and then we're going to get another action potential. So that's what we would see if we were monitoring the SA node. It's kind of a crooked action potential. You have to pretend like that peak's a little bit straighter. And every time this would fire from the SA node, then it's going to be picked up by the surrounding tissue. Because of the tight connections between the muscle cells, it's going to be picked up and it's going to spread. Then these action potentials will spread across that muscle tissue and cause the contraction of that muscle. So here we'll see the contraction of the atria, and then of course that'll get picked up by the AV node and take it down to the ventricles, and the ventricles will contract. It's all electrical like this. But that's what we would be seeing. The rate at which the heart is beating depends upon the slope of this line. How steep is this line? How fast is that potassium channel shutting down? Is it shutting down rapidly? Is it shutting down slowly? That's going to determine how frequently that heart's going to beat. So the slope of this line really is going to determine that. And it's the slope of that line that norepinephrine and acetylcholine play with. Under the influence of acetylcholine, we see that rate of shutting down slows down. So it takes longer for that channel to shut down. So the potassium channel shuts down more slowly. Now, if that channel is shutting down more slowly, that means that we're going to get we're going to depolarize. It's going to take longer to depolarize. Okay, it will depolarize eventually, but it's just going to take longer because we've slowed down the rate of shutting down that channel, and so we will get. I had better not do this. I'll be sorry. Let me change colors here. So this is under the influence of acetylcholine. Well, once we hit the critical level, we're going to get the action potential, right? And it's going to go on, and then we're going to have the same thing happen again, only we've shut down the rate, so it's going to take longer, and then we'll get another action potential. So that's going to slow down the rate of the heartbeat, okay, because it's taking longer to depolarize. And so we'll get less frequent action potentials from the SA node. And remember, that's what's driving. There's nothing else out there that is really even approaching the rate at which the SA node is depolarizing. And so that will drive that. With norepinephrine, it's just the opposite. With norepinephrine, the potassium channel shuts down more rapidly. So that increases the slope of this line. So and with norepinephrine, we might see something like this, where hopefully that shows up. But it will shut down much more rapidly. And by doing that, that means that, that it's going to depolarize more rapidly. And if it's depolarizing more rapidly, then we're going to get action potentials generated more frequently. And so norepinephrine is going to do that. It's going to make the potassium channel shut down more rapidly, so we'll get much more frequent depolarizations, whereas acetylcholine shuts it down more slowly, so we'll get less frequent depolarizations. If we're seeing the effect of neither of them, if neither of them is there, then we'll get whatever the innate rate for that shutdown is in the absence of norepinephrine or acetylcholine. Okay, I hope that makes sense. That's how we're regulating the rate of heartbeat. We're just regulating how fast those cells are automatically depolarizing. Polarize more rapidly, more rapid rate of heartbeat, less rapidly, a less rapid rate of heartbeat. So hopefully that solves one mystery, at least. That's how those neurotransmitters are working. Of course, to do that, they're going to be binding to proteins, unique proteins that are going to affect that potassium channel and cause it to speed up or slow down, whatever's going on there. Now, second mystery. If we look at, I don't have a picture now, do I? If we look at the action potentials that we've been talking about, okay, you may remember that on one of them, let me just draw one out really quick. You don't need to draw this out. I just want to, just for the effect here. So this was our kind of our tip. Here's our resting potential, hit the critical level, boom, there's an action potential, and then so forth. Remember I told you that this whole event is about 6 milliseconds, or 6/1000ths of a second for an action potential. That's how long it takes for that to occur. If that were true in the heart, we would never see an electrocardiogram. Remember, the electrocardiogram is showing us electrical activity, it's showing us depolarization and repolarization. The QRS wave was the depolarization of the ventricles, which is the action potential spreading across the ventricles. The T wave was the repolarization of the ventricles, which was the action potentials repolarizing, exactly what it says. The action potential is passed now, and they're repolarizing, they're reestablishing their polarity. And you may remember, certainly, when we did the recordings in the lab, you could clearly see a time period between the depolarization of the ventricles and the repolarization. And you measured them, and I don't remember what those numbers were anymore, but we can actually measure that time. Well, if that were a 6-millisecond event, there's no way in the world we'd be able to measure that time. Right? So, second thing that goes on in heart muscle is that the action potential actually looks different from what it looks like here. So that's a 6-millisecond event. In the heart, if we were to monitor, let's go out into the heart muscle tissue itself and monitor that action potential as it passes by a particular area using intracellular recordings, we see something like this. Oopsie. See something like this where, okay, there's our upswing. Okay, that's the sodium rushing out of the cell. I'm sorry, it's sodium rushing into the cell. Sodium rushing in, that's our upswing. And then we would expect the potassium gates to open and potassium to rush out. Doesn't happen right away. And in fact, what'll happen is we'll get kind of a delayed response, and eventually that's going to go ahead and the potassium gates are going to open, potassium is going to rush out. Calcium ions are involved in this too, but we're not going to bring them into the story right now. Okay, this whole event in the heart is about 250 milliseconds. And that's why we can see the depolarization and the repolarization events on the electrocardiogram. If it weren't for that, we wouldn't be able to see those two separate events. Okay, so a different kind of action potential. Now, this also has implications in rate of heartbeat. Okay, so if your action potential is taking 250 milliseconds, it's taking a quarter of a second, what's the fastest that heart can beat?
Beats
per minute, right? Because your action potential is taking a quarter of a second to occur. What's considered the upper limit of heart rate for people? Number that's oftentimes used, somewhere around 220, 230, something like that. All right, you can't. Or otherwise, we're going to run into the refractory period. So that's why we've got kind of that upper limit. Besides, if your heart is beating faster than that, it's not going to be efficient at all. Even at that rate, its efficiency is probably going down in terms of getting filled for the next heartbeat. Trained athletes' heart rates will perhaps approach that, maybe 180, 190 beats per minute, something like that, if they're out really exercising hard and so forth. But that's kind of a theoretical upper limit for the rate of heartbeat, controlled by the length of time of the action potential. So a very different kind of action potential, even though the things that are happening are pretty much the same as the things that are happening in the nerve. Very, very different kinetics, a very different time scale as to how those things are happening. And again, that's why we can look at that electrocardiogram and we can see the parts on the electrocardiogram that we can actually see and not just one spike of activity and that be that. Okay, any questions about that idea? Okay, so just a couple other things to clean up here, and we're going to be done with the nervous system. I want to get on, and we're going to start talking about the reproductive system, and I want to talk with you a little bit about meiosis yet today, the lab that you had last week, and tell you a few things to get you ready for this week's lab, but a little more cleanup here. So there in the middle of page 66, neuromuscular junctions, nerve-muscle junctions. Okay, so we talked about those last time when we looked at the synapse. We saw the acetylcholine going across the synapse, causing the muscle to contract by stimulating another action potential that spreads across the muscle. So we've talked about those kinds of things. And so 1 and 2 there, we've really kind of covered already. What I did want to mention is this idea of a graded response. So with a motor neuron. Remember when we were talking, way back when we were talking about motor neurons, I mentioned that with motor neurons, their axons tend to be branching. And so ignoring what's going on at the incoming end, okay, I'll just draw my usual little cell body there or something, and I'm just going to draw the axon as a single line. These axons are going to be branching and branching and branching. Okay, and each one of those is going to terminate on a muscle fiber. So there can be as many as 200 muscle fibers that are innervated by a single motor neuron. So every time an action potential would go down this motor neuron, it would spread out and it would then go to all of those different muscle fibers that the motor neuron is connected to. So it's not just a one-to-one relationship by any means. It's got this multiple relationship. And this is what we call a motor unit. Motor unit. So the motor neuron and all of its different fibers that it's attached to. And we've got thousands upon thousands of motor neurons. And we control, we get a graded response where we can squeeze something very gently, or we can squeeze something very hard, or we can squeeze things all in between. We can lift very light things easily. We can lift heavier things and so forth. A graded response by how many motor units get pulled into play. So our brain's going to do that. It's going to determine how many motor units need to be pulled in to make this action happen that we want to have happen. So if it's a very light touch sort of thing, probably not very many motor units are going to be involved. And so even though those particular muscle fibers are going to be contracting all they can contract, because your muscles are actually made out of millions of fibers, if you've only got a few of those contracting at any one time, you're going to get a very light contraction. On the other hand, if you're trying to squeeze something as hard as you can, then your brain is going to send down stimulatory information to a whole bunch more of those motor units and involve them and get them going so that a whole lot more of that muscle now is involved in that contraction. So when we contract a muscle, it's not just like the whole muscle has to contract or not. The muscle is composed of fibers, and it's those individual fibers. How many of those fibers are contracting at any given time that gives us that graded response? Which is a really useful thing to have. There are times when you just don't want to use your full force to pick something up or whatever. And there are other times when you absolutely have to. So it's really a useful sort of thing. So keep that in mind, a graded response with the motor units. Now, one thing that I haven't said a lot about yet is sensory input. So I wanted to say a little bit about sensory input, because sensory input is really interesting in my mind. How do we get the sensory input that we get? How is it that we can see light and we can hear sound and we can feel touch and we can smell smells and we can taste tastes and all of those different things? Well, back when we were talking about sensory neurons, remember I talked about how the dendrites, the incoming ends of those, were all specialized to receive different stimuli. So in our eyes, and we'll go to the eyes in just a second, we've got cells that are specialized to react to light. When certain chemicals in the cells absorb light, then it causes reactions to occur. And ultimately, those reactions that occur translate into action potentials. Action potentials feed into the brain, and the brain puts this all together. The brain assembles that those action potentials coming in into images and into colors in the images and so forth. What about smell? In your nose, you've got nerves with specialized endings that different kinds of chemicals that you might come across in the air will bind to, either tightly or not so tightly or whatever, but as they bind to those nerve endings, then action potentials are generated. And those action potentials feed into the brain again. And your brain generates a sensation. You say, oh, I just smelled something. That was good or that was bad, or that was in between. I just smelled something. Or taste, same way, except we're dealing in the liquid environment, right? So we have taste buds to which different chemicals can bind, and when they do, they send action potentials to the brain where that's generated into a sense of taste. And so on. Touch, pressure. We have pressure sensors. Sensory neurons that are pressure sensors. And by deforming those little pressure sensors, then action potentials are generated that go to the brain, where that sense of feel is generated, and so on. So sensory input, it really depends upon the nature of the sensory neurons, the dendrites that you have. Now, we certainly can't see everything in the world around us. We know that insects are sensitive to ultraviolet light at much lower wavelengths than we are. So there's a whole visual world out there that insects can see that we can't see. And there were six computers just being wheeled by. that are creating static. Okay, so, you know, just because we can't see something doesn't mean that other organisms can't. Why can't we see into the ultraviolet like insects can? Because our nerve cells are not sensitive to those wavelengths. We don't absorb those wavelengths. We don't have any way of translating those wavelengths into action potentials that can be processed by the brain. So the key to this whole thing is that the sensory neurons generate action potentials that get fed into the brain, and it's in the brain, the different areas of the brain, where those action potentials that are being fed in actually get interpreted as sight, or as hearing, or as smell, or as taste, or as whatever. And that's always intrigued me. You got one kind of signal going in, and it's going to a particular area. Let's take a little closer look at vision, just real quickly here. So there on page 67, you've got a artist's drawing of what the back of the eye, the retina, might look like. The retina is a real thin layer at the back of the eye that has the visual sensory neurons in it. And you're all probably aware that there are two different kinds. There are the cones that give us color vision, and then there are the rods that give us just black and white vision. The rods are much more sensitive than the cones, so as the light level starts to go down, at some point you'll switch over to black and white vision, because you'll lose your color vision. But usually you're not aware of that because of what's going on. And our brains have ways of, you know, kind of making up for that anyway. One of the intriguing things about the retina, I think, is that the light-sensitive cells all point to the back of the eye. You think, oh, wait a minute, isn't the light coming in from the front? Aren't the cells supposed to be pointing to the front where the light's coming in? And I would say, yes, I suppose if I were designing this, I would design it that way. However, when you examine eyes, you see that all the light-sensitive cells are pointed to the back of the eye, not the front. Now, what's the value in this? It turns out that there's a coating on the back that the retina sits on that the light is going to reflect off of. So as the light comes in, it's got to go through all of those neurons, right? It's got to go through those and then reflect off the back of the eye and then back into those neurons where they're going to absorb the light energy and they're going to generate action potentials. Now for us, if we were to take somebody's eye and dissect it and take a look at it, we see that the back of that eye is kind of murky in color. It's not highly reflective or anything like that. And you know, from taking pictures of people with flashes, you know, the old red eye sort of a thing, you know, why do you get red eye in photographs? Well, light's going in, and what you're seeing, you're seeing the blood in the retina that's being reflected back, and that's what's giving you that really nice, pretty red color to the eyes that nobody likes, because that's nobody wants to have red eye. So that's us. Well, what happens if you take a flash picture, say, of your pet dog? Do they have red eyes? No. What do? They got these eerie, glowy eyes, right? It's the green eye syndrome for the pets, so kind of different colors of green. That's because they have a much more reflective layer in the back. And that gives them much better night vision. Okay, the more reflective the layer in the back, the more light you're going to be able to reflect into those rods and cones. Same with deer and other kinds of animals, especially night active animals, you know, the little glowing eyes that you might see here and there, and you know there's something there because the eyes are glowing back at you. It's because that layer is very, very, very reflective. So it gives the possibility of having different kinds of eyes, some that are less reflective, some that are more reflective. And our night vision really isn't all that great, right? So we use electric lights, have for the last 100 plus years, and so forth, candles before that. But a lot of animals can see really, really well in the dark because of their layers. Now, let's talk about black and white vision real quick. You've got a picture there at the bottom of a molecule, and you don't have to worry about, am I going to ever show you that molecule on the test? No, I will not. You don't have to know it. And we can kind of draw a schematic of it, looks like this, and then it has a bend in it. Okay, this is a molecule called cis-retinaldehyde. And it attaches to a protein that sits in the membrane of, or at one of the inner membranes of a rod cell. Okay, so it's the light-sensitive cell. So you can kind of imagine it kind of being this big protein that's on here, and this is sitting in the membrane of that cell, cis-retinaldehyde. This molecule, the cis-retinaldehyde with this called opsin, is what we call rhodopsin. So you're probably familiar with that term. The rhodopsin is the light-sensitive molecule for black and white vision. Well, what happens? If you're in the absolute dark, all of your rhodopsin is going to look like this. It's all going to be in this cis form, this little bent form, and so forth. If as little as one photon of light, we have really sensitive black and white vision, one photon of light strikes this. So there's light energy. One photon strikes it, it gets absorbed by this retinaldehyde, and when that happens, it causes a transformation in the shape, and it switches to that other form. So in your lecture notes, you got the resting versus the excited. So it's going to cause that to straighten out. This is called trance retinaldehyde. The only thing that's happened is one single bond has been broken, it's rotated around, and it's been reattached again. So it's straightened out. But the thing is, the straightened version can't stay on the opsin. So that breaks it off. So really, I shouldn't have drawn it like that. This is going to break off. So our trans-retinaldehyde is really going to be gone from the rhodopsin molecule. And so we'd have a situation like this. So there's the opsin with the retinaldehyde broken off. That's the event. That's what light does. Okay, and that's enough to stimulate action potentials in the optic nerve that then transfer that information to the brain where it's interpreted. It's like, oh, we've seen something now. Okay? In the dark, this will get reattached. So we'll put that, we'll recreate the cis retinaldehyde and then reattach it to the opsin to regenerate the rhodopsin. In the light, we're constantly breaking it off in the dark glow. And we're reattaching it then too. But depending on the amount of light, we've constantly got a bunch of that broken off. But in the dark glow, we'll reattach that. That's why dark adaptation occurs. You know, if you're in the dark for like a half hour period or something, you see things much better if there's a little bit of light than if you just walk into the dark, because you're getting more and more of that rhodopsin regenerated, and so it's available to receive light. The interesting thing about the rod cells is they kind of violate everything I've told you, because this event actually hyperpolarizes them. Don't ask me why, but that's the event that causes them to then send information to the next cell that depolarizes it and sends an action potential on into the brain. So you can file that away if you want. Ultimately, this is going to cause depolarizations, action potentials that go into the brain. So if we were to look at the brain, then, oh dear, there's a brain. The outer layer is called the cortex. And a lot of the sensations that we know are generated in the cortex, the sensory cortex out here. the visual center is somewhere kind of towards the back, so we've got information coming in here from the eye. Okay, sending information in, getting back here, being interpreted and so forth. Oh, look what I just saw. Auditory center is a little closer to the front here. So here we've got information coming in from the ear. Oh boy, what does an ear look like? Sort of. Okay, gonna leave it at that. No. Don't want to go there. Just leave well enough alone. This is an ear. So auditory information coming in here, visual information coming in here. It's all action potentials. I've often thought, what would it be like if you had to go in for brain surgery or something, and that particular day happened to be multiple personalities day for the surgeon, and the evil twin personality showed up. Okay, does a fine job on your brain surgery, but goes in and switches the nerves, the auditory nerve and the visual nerve, switches those two nerves. So that now we have auditory information feeding into the visual cortex and visual information feeding into the auditory cortex. What would it be like to hear lightning and see thunder? Because those sensations are created by where that information is going into the brain, right? And it's all action potentials being fed into those areas. I get strange thoughts sometimes, but I don't know if it would work or not, so I probably won't try it on any of you. But interesting idea. Anyway, it just reinforces the idea. It's all action potentials feeding, and it's the brain that's generating those sensations that we have. And we really don't understand how that's happening yet. Let's take a break. When we come back, a couple things to finish up, and we'll move on. Okay. Let's get going again. I wanted to show you some images real quick. This is kind of a review of things that we've been talking about with the nervous system. So kind of a crazy animation that I found. It's not like it's exactly correct. Your nerve cell wouldn't explode like that when something comes in, but at least you get the feel for information coming in and then going on out. That's obviously the axon down there. The structure, again, we've been looking at, and there's a photo micrograph of brain cells in the tissue. So there's a large neuron. I'm not quite sure how they know that the arrow is pointing at an axon, because it's really hard to tell in those situations, but I guess we'll believe them at this point. So, nerve cells. We talked about, again, synaptic transmission, right? So here's a little graphic. There are the little packets with the neurotransmitter in it. Action potential gets to the end, releases some of those, not all of them, by any means, not all of them. In fact, people have done computations how many little packets of acetylcholine probably get released from a motor neuron each time and so forth. And it's a low number, it's like 50 or something. It's not hundreds or anything. Though, and then there's the receptor protein that these have to bind with, and then they cause events to occur in the postsynaptic cell. So synaptic transmission. This is a artist's drawing of what that sodium channel might look like in a neuromuscular synapse that the acetylcholine is going over and binding with. So this would be the protein itself. This is the membrane, so it's kind of spanning it. And then if you rotate that up, you can see, oh, look, there's a little opening. That's the channel itself. Ordinarily, that would be closed down, and that size may be enough to close it down, depending on the size of the sodium with this water around it. You get an acetylcholine to bind out here, that would open that channel up and would allow sodium to flow through that channel. So here's from side view. You can see it's a little bit like almost funnel-shaped up here, and then there's the channel where it closes down and then it opens on the inside. So that's the sort of thing that I've been talking about with these protein receptors allowing sodium to leak in. And once the acetylcholine came unbound, then that hole will close up again. So open and close. Yep. Here's a picture of a nerve muscle junction. So these are muscle fibers. Here's a motor neuron, one part of one axon, one branch of an axon of the motor neuron coming in, and there's the end plate. So you can see how closely pressed that they are at that point. And if we look here, here's a motor unit. You can see several branches coming in and with them synapsing to all of these different muscle fibers. And so information coming down this motor neuron would cause all of these muscle fibers to contract. But as I said, that's just a few muscle fibers out of the millions that make up a muscle. So great response. Here's a cross-section of a nerve. When I don't want to leave you with the impression that an axon is a nerve. Okay, they're nerve cells. But a nerve, what we talk of as a nerve, like the sciatic nerve or this nerve or that nerve, is really a fairly large bundle of axons, a bundle of nerve cells. And so here, cut in cross-section, you can see all of these little circles would be axons. And you can see how they're bundled together. And that's probably a really small bundle there, too. So when we talk about a nerve, we're really talking about a whole bunch of neurons that are traveling together to go to locations, not just single neurons that are going somewhere. We talked about reflex arcs. I just wanted to bring that up again. This is kind of where we started. I don't want you to forget about these. Or sensory input coming in, there's the little associative neuron, motor neuron going out, there's the effector organ, the muscle in this case, that would be used by that particular reflex arc. And of course we saw that they're actually more complex than that. So this is another view. So we've got information coming in that may be a stretch receptor or something, say, oh, wait a minute, this muscle got stretched, we need to correct that problem. So information, sensory information coming in. There's our associative neuron. They call it an inhibitory neuron. Oh, that's not good. Anyway, we've got the associative neurons in here making connections, inhibitory neurons. And you notice how we got this one synapsing with this motor neuron, this one with this one. So we talked about how if we want stimulatory information to go out to this nerve, then we want inhibitory information on this nerve. And we do that, remember, at the level of the motor neuron. So we're hyperpolarizing this motor neuron, we are depolarizing this motor neuron, and that's giving us the desired effect. So we'll be able to go ahead and contract that muscle in response to a stretch and overstretch, and this muscle is going to be relaxed and not fighting that whole thing. So reflex arcs. Okay. Any residual questions about the nervous system before we turn another page here? I know it's been a quick and dirty tour. It sort of is of all of these things that we're talking about. So, the last system we're going to be looking at is the reproductive system. And you began that on last week with the lab on meiosis. And I have a few thoughts that I want to share with you today about that, and a little bit of information to prep you for this week's lab. It's not going to take a whole lot of preparation to be able to do that, what we're going to be doing this week. So we're over on page 70, and it starts off with asexual versus sexual reproduction. I'm sure you talked about that in lab a little bit. There was a question I know on the lab homework for last week about the distinction between sexual and asexual reproduction. In talking with the lab instructors, in fact, yesterday at our weekly meeting, we were talking about some of the answers that people came up with in what is the distinction between sexual and asexual reproduction. And there were some misconceptions that people had. For example, the idea that asexual reproduction is for single-celled organisms, and sexual reproduction is for multicellular organisms. And that's just not that's just not right. Single-celled organisms certainly reproduce asexually by dividing, but it's not unusual for single-celled organisms to have some sort of ability to undergo some sort of sexual reproduction also. And sexual reproduction being defined as involving a bringing together of chromosomes and then a separating of them also, like we see in us. So, and then the other part of that misconception is that sexual reproduction is for multicellular organisms, and certainly most multicellular organisms probably have the ability to reproduce asexually as well as sexually. Okay, so a lot of organisms can be cloned. Cloning would be asexual reproduction. Plants, many, many plants, take a cutting of a plant or any number of ways to clone plants to wind up with additional plants that are genetically identical to that first plant that we started with and so forth. Animals, a lot of the lower invertebrate animals have ways of budding off additional offspring and so forth, so basically cloning themselves with additional offspring. So sexual versus asexual isn't an issue of single cell versus multicell. Okay? It's really more of an issue of chromosomes and what's going on, and really the key thing that sets sexual reproduction apart from asexual is that the beginning of sexual reproduction involves the fusion of two gametes. All right, now we're going to be looking at that in lab this week. We're going to be looking at gamete production and the fusion of gametes in lab. So it's the fusion of gametes, the fusion of what we tend to call an egg cell and the sperm cell together to form that new individual. And it involves then the bringing together of sets of chromosomes, a set of chromosomes from the mother, a set of chromosomes from the father, what we call the mother and father, though, or the female and the male, and sometimes that gets a little bit, the lines get blurred depending on what organisms that we're talking about, but we tend to use that terminology. We tend to say that the big gamete, there generally is a larger gamete and a smaller gamete, though that's not always the case. Sometimes the gametes are the same size. But generally there's a bigger and a smaller because that bigger gamete has to retain nutrients for early development. We tend to call that the female gamete, and we tend to call the smaller gamete the male gamete. Generally, one of those two is going to be motile, and it'll be the smaller one, and the other one's going to be non-motile, and that'll typically be the larger one, though looking at different kinds of organisms, that's not always true either. So there are these broad generalizations that we use when we talk about sexual reproduction. But the key event would be the fusion of gametes. We don't see that with asexual reproduction. So with asexual reproduction, we're getting more of the same, basically, although there's still mutation that can go on and other things that can cause shifts and changes, but certainly not to the degree that we see with sexual reproduction, where we wind up getting new combinations of genes put together in the offspring that have come from the parents of the organisms that are donating those gametes to begin with. So don't get caught in the rut of thinking, well, like I've been telling you about. We find those processes involved in most different organisms, both of them involved in most different organisms. So, that having been said, let's talk about sexual reproduction. Leave behind the world of asexual reproduction and talk about sexual reproduction now. So, generally, there are three or four different processes that are involved in sexual reproduction. So, their number two under sexual reproduction usually includes, and I'm going to give you actually a fourth one to add to that list. So the first one, you should all be able to guess now what the answer is, fusion of gametes, right? So we're going to bring a pair of gametes together. They're going to fuse. After the gametes come together, then we see multiple mitotic cell divisions. Mitotic cell divisions, okay? So obviously right now I'm talking about a multicellular organism. So multiple mitotic cell divisions. That's followed at some point, and actually I should probably should say is inserted into these multiple mitotic divisions at some point, with some sort of differentiation process. Differentiation simply means that cells are becoming different. Right, they're becoming specialized. And certainly you can understand that with everything that we've talked about in the human body, all the different kinds of cell types and so forth that we have within us that make the functional individual. Those have all differentiated at some point in time to form the different kinds of tissues and cells that we're made up of. So fusion of gametes followed by multiple mitotic cell divisions, some sort of differentiation process, and eventually some sort of growth maturation process. So we'll see that young organism will typically grow larger and mature. There may be different stages that we call larval stages that you go through, where they look very different from one stage to the next, maybe not. It's highly variable, but some sort of growth and maturation process is involved in usually in sexual reproduction, especially of the multicellular kinds of organisms. Now, let me draw a diagram, and unfortunately I see there's nowhere, no space left in the lecture notes for this diagram that I'm going to draw you. So if you could find a little space somewhere to do this. What does this look like? So here's an egg and a sperm. Okay, so this would be an unfertilized egg. And a sperm. Those are our gametes. That are going to fuse. So there's our first step. So they come together, and now we've got one fertilized egg. And of course, we can't leave anything alone. We can't keep calling that a fertilized egg. The appropriate term for this is a zygote. So we got a fertilized egg now, or a zygote. At some point, we'll get the multiple mitotic divisions beginning, and generally they're synchronized, and so we might find that zygote's going to divide into two. So this is what we call the two-cell stage. And oftentimes, then, when the next time it divides, it's going to divide in a different plane. So let's say that this divided in the X plane here, back and forth. And the next time, it might divide in the Y plane, up and down. So this would be now a four-cell stage. And it's not unusual now for the next time for the division to occur, for that to happen in the Z plane. What in the world is a Z plane? It's perpendicular to the Y, so these four cells are going to divide in the plane actually of this transparency. So if we could look and see, we'd see now that there are going to be four cells in front sitting on four cells in back. So this would be the 8-cell stage. And they'll continue dividing mitotically. As I said, very often these are synchronized. So as you watch the divisions occur, if you keep track of how many divisions you've gone through, you know what stage you're in. Eventually, we're going to wind up with a solid ball of cells. Solid ball that's called a morula. And that's probably around the 16, 32 cell stage, something like that, 64 cells, solid ball. And as those continue to divide, the divisions will occur towards the outside, and that solid ball is going to hollow out. So we wind up with a hollow ball of cells. So solid ball, and then if we're in cross-section, we might then wind up with this hollow ball of cells, where these are all the cells out here. That's called a blastula. It's kind of like if we were going from a big softball to a small basketball. What are those? They're little balls that are smaller, but they're air-filled. Let's call it a basketball. So we're going from a solid ball of cells like a softball to a hollow ball of cells like a basketball, where the skin of that basketball is the cells, and the air in the middle is a fluid-filled chamber in the middle. And then these cells are going to start moving. So this was all mitotic divisions, right? And then the third thing was differentiation process. And so that's where these cells start to move. And what they'll do is they'll start to poke in at one end. It's kind of like if you had that basketball, say, and let's assume that it's not just absolutely full of air. Okay, so it's round, but it's not full of air. You take your fist and start to punch in at one spot, and then that basketball is going to move in. Well, these cells do that. So we get this where we form a progressively larger tube in the middle, which eventually pokes through and forms the digestive tract. And this is called, so this is a differentiating ball of cells called a gastrula. And then they're going to go on from there to form maybe some sort of a juvenile to maybe various stages to the adult. So there's growth and maturation going on there too. Okay, so that's a kind of a typical thing. We're going to be looking for these stages in lab this week. Okay, we're going to be looking at starfish. Slides of starfish development where the eggs have been some aren't fertilized, some are, and looking for a bunch of these stages. So you're going to get the chance to look at real live dead material, it's dead now, and look for these different stages, and I think they'll hopefully make more sense to you at that point. Okay, so let me stop there, and I'll see some of you in lab and the rest of you Thursday.